Meeting of the House Resources Committee to order. It is 1:54 p.m. on Wednesday, April 5th. Members present at this time, Representative Chris Birch, Representative Justin Parrish, Representative Dave Tallarico, Representative George Rauscher, Representative Harriet Drummond, our Vice Chair, Representative Dean Westlake, Co-Chair, Representative Josephson, and myself, Representative Tarr. Please let the record reflect that we do have a quorum to conduct business. Joining us, our lovely assistant, Ms. Tillinghast, thank you so much, and Mr. Cole, thank you for being with us today, our LAO moderator. We're running quite a bit behind, so we're going to do our best to get through the agenda today. If there was anybody interested in House Bill 177, this is aquatic invasive species, it's likely this bill will not come before the committee today, but will be on the calendar for Friday. We're going to start with a presentation from the Department of Environmental Conservation, an update on the Hillcorp spills in the Cook Inlet. Hopefully folks have received some information about a unified command. There was a letter coming around the building yesterday from Hillcorp talking about that, and we'll hear from Kristen Ryan, our director for the Spill Prevention and Response Division at DEC. So if we could have Ms. Ryan please join us. She'll be on by phone.
Good afternoon.
Thank you. Please go ahead and give us an update on both of the situations.
Okay. Well, for the record, my name is Kristen Ryan, and I'm the director for the Division of Spill Prevention and Response for the State of Alaska, and that is in the Department of Environmental Conservation. As the committee is aware, there has been two events in Cook Inlet over the past couple weeks, both related to infrastructure owned by Hillcorp. The first event was a natural gas leak out of a pipeline that services platforms on the east side of Cook Inlet. As a result of that rupture in that pipeline, there was visual imagery of bubbling methane that was run through that line. This is a pipeline that served those platforms with methane from the land. So this is a pipeline running to the platforms, providing a form of gas that the pipe that the platforms use to produce oil. There's four platforms served by that line. Only two were producing oil at the time of the rupture. The company reduced the amount of methane running through that line to about half of the more than half by the time they were done, from the original pressure down to 65 psi, which is what it currently is running at right now. They're doing that because it allows enough gas to continue to reach the platform so they can operate critical pieces of equipment. In particular, it allows them to operate pumps, and those pumps are necessary because they will keep the seawater flowing through the other line, which is that was set up to take oil from the platforms to land. And because of the temperature, you want to keep a fluid moving through that line so that it doesn't freeze up. And the pumps are necessary to run that seawater through that line. There is no more oil in that line. They've closed in those wells. They can't operate the platforms with this limited amount of methane, but it does provide enough energy for them to operate the pumps and navigational equipment that allows mariners to see the platforms. That does mean there's a continual methane release occurring still, but it's at a much reduced rate. Hillcorp is continuing to monitor for the environmental impacts of that release and conducting testing on the salinity, and the most important factor we're interested in is dissolved oxygen. The methane displaces oxygen in the water column, and the fish need oxygen in the water column to breathe. So that's the biggest environmental concern that we're monitoring for. I have not seen the latest data from Hillcorp, but their initial data provided us some information about how much methane was in the water and how much displacement was occurring. We want more information. We found that their first data to be sort of inconclusive, and we need more information before we really understand what's going on there. I will stop there on that first event. Is there any questions from the committee regarding that particular problem?
Yes, several questions. We'll start with Representative Rauscher, then there was Josephson, then Birch.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair, I was wondering, who actually owns the pipe?
Representative, through the chair, the pipe is owned by Hillcorp.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay. Representative Josephson.
Yes, thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Ms. Ryan, the Dispatch News, which is a source that we all use, or at least I do, noted recently that your department would have to consider whether Alaska regulations needs updating to prevent future problems. And here they're talking about, in that story, the oil leak, but I'm wondering whether that it would be true for the natural gas leak as well.
Representative Josephson, through the chair, the Department of Environmental Conservation does not have any regulations pertaining to natural gas pipelines right now. There is statutory authority, but historically, the state's interest in natural gas has been limited to public safety concerns, the avoidance, obviously, of an explosion where, you know, human lives could be hurt. There's never been an environmental element to our concerns with natural gas pipelines. If it's above land, you know, it dissipates into the air, so there really isn't an environmental risk of concern. The pipelines underwater, which there are more than this one in Cook Inlet, haven't really been on our radar. I will say they are regulated by the federal organization called PHMSA, and that organization has issued several orders to Hillcorp about this pipeline and the oil pipeline that's related to it. So the state hasn't, up to this point, really gotten into environmental regulation of natural gas pipelines.
Follow-up?
Ms. Ryan, I guess I'm just confused because you just described how there were concerns with methane displacing oxygen, and you mentioned the U.S. Pipeline Hazardous Material Safety Administration has concerns. The administration broadly has had concerns, and the governor has expressed those concerns. And I guess what I'm wondering is, is it your statement that DEC has no way to regulate the discharge of natural gas under the water? That it has no authority over that act?
Representative Josephson, through the chair, we have authority. You are not allowed to discharge something harmful in the environment, no matter what it is. So we have our broad generic authority that you cannot pollute. And that's what we've been utilizing to regulate this pipeline. We don't have specific regulations pertaining to natural gas pipelines, though, like we do for oil lines, is what I'm saying.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Birch, and before you say that, I just want to announce again, because two people have joined online for House Bill 177 on aquatic invasive species, we will not have time to take that measure up today. That will be moved to Friday. So Ms. Lisa Evans from Department of Fish and Game and Mr. Carter from Division of Ag, I don't want to use any of your time unnecessarily. We won't be able to hear that today, but we will on Friday and hope you can join us then. Representative Birch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just as a data point, some of us don't rely on the aforementioned newspaper. So just as a data point, I did want to ask, has Hillcorp, to the extent that they've been involved with this, have they been cooperative? I guess that would be to Ms. Ryan.
Representative Birch, through the chair, Hillcorp has been cooperative and working with the department to minimize this release. When we initially asked them to get data, before they had reduced the pressure in the line and were continuing to release methane at double the amount they are now, we had some concerns about the environmental impact of that and asked them to do all this monitoring that they're doing now so that we can get some data to verify if there is a negative impact occurring. So to their credit, they have done everything we've asked them to do, even though we're, as I already mentioned, we really don't have specific regulations requiring this activity. We're just using our generic authority of, you know, of a concern there might be damage to the environment that's occurring.
Okay, follow-up?
Follow-up.
I used to work at Alyeska Pipeline. We reported daily, right, see reports out of Valdez as small amounts as a teaspoonful. I guess the question is this something that was self-reported, or did somebody, you know, come across this, or how was this incident discovered and reported?
Representative Birch, through the chair, it was self-reported.
It was, okay.
The company told PHMSA and DEC of the release.
Okay.
And the follow-up?
Through the chair. Now, it's my understanding they've got there's positive pressure is remains on the line, so there's there's some sort of methane discharge then at a reduced pressure? Is it?
Representative Birch, to the chair, yes. So that's one of the other benefits that I forgot to mention. For allowing some methane to continue to run through that line, it allows the line to maintain positive pressure so that seawater does not infiltrate the line. The reason that's of concern is the company, this line used to be an oil line. It used to run the other direction. It used to run oil from the platforms to the shore, and was converted to a gas line, I think in 2012, and reversed. So there's concern, there's residual oil in that line, and if it's infiltrated with seawater, we could see some of that released from the leak. So that is one of the other benefits for keeping positive pressure in the line and keeping some gas flowing through it.
And another follow-up?
Have there been any estimates as to the quantity of oil, or, you know, who has made those estimates, or where? I mean, I don't know what sort of volumes we're talking about, if that's been estimated at all, through the chair.
Representative Birch, to the chair. So there's been no oil released in this incident.
Oh, great. Okay. So that's very good, actually. And then lastly, on through the chair, on methane, I seem to remember a science experiment in Fairbanks one time on, I think it was Blaine Lake Road, where they had actually naturally occurring methane came up underneath the ice, and a guy was, you know, lighting a flare above the ice. And I'm not familiar with that down here. Are there naturally occurring amounts of methane in the Cook Inlet? And do you see them at all? Or?
Representative Birch, through the chair, there's a lot of naturally occurring methane in Alaska. I don't know if we have any natural seeps in Cook Inlet in particular. I wouldn't be surprised. But yes, there was actually an article related to this incident on APRN that highlighted that. They interviewed a researcher from the University of Fairbanks that was showing how much natural methane is just seeping out of our earth on a pretty regular basis throughout the state.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
I want to recognize that Representative Johnson joined us about 2 minutes ago at 2:05. And where we're at in the queue here, we've got Representative Parrish, then Representative Rauscher, then back to Representative Josephson. Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've got a few more questions. My recollection is that from December until they reduced pressure, which was late in March, we were losing approximately 250,000 cubic feet a day. Is that about right?
Yes.
And now that they've reduced pressure, it's approximately half that. And when did they reduce pressure again?
Representative, through the chair, sorry, I've been a little distracted by this other event. I believe that was last Friday that they were able to shut the wells in. That was sort of the first thing that had to happen. They had to safely shut in the production wells on the two platforms that were still producing oil. And then once that was done, they were able to reduce the flow. And my understanding is that occurred Friday. I'm trying to look at the calendar to tell you the day. Probably the 24th.
Follow-up, Representative Parrish.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. So approximately how many millions of cubic feet of methane have bubbled away so far?
Representative, through the chair, I don't know that off the top of my head. I would have to run a calculation for you.
Okay, I might do that here on my notepad and get back to you. It's my understanding that there are a fair few pipelines with residual oil. Can those be cleaned out with pigs? Has that already been done?
Representative Parrish, through the chair, yes. Pigs are being utilized in these lines as well, and this line has been pigged in the past, so it has already been cleaned, I guess, at some point, and it's before it was transferred over to a gas line. And as far as I understand it, Hilcorp plans to run a pig through the oil line as well. They're using this as an opportunity to do some work on that line before they start operations again.
Continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Approximately how many lines are there of a similar status that are currently being used to transfer natural gas, which may spring a leak as they're dragged over the floor seabed as rocks roll against them?
Representative Parrish, through the chair, I don't know that number off the top of my head. We have some old infrastructure reports that were completed in 2000. We're pulling that out and we're looking at it. And then, of course, we have we regulate the oil lines, so I have a little better sense of what's going on there. But the natural gas lines isn't something we've historically kept track of in the past.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mm-hmm. Representative Rauscher.
Yes, through the chair, I was just wondering, what was the cause of the rupture?
Representative Rauscher, through the chair, we do not know that yet. They have been unable to put divers in the water, which is also the problem they're having on the other release I'll talk about next. We're hoping ice coverage diminishes so that they can do that soon. But until they get a diver in the water, we do not know the cause of the break.
Then through the chair, then we don't know how big the is. It we don't even know if it's a crack or whatever it is, right?
Representative Rauscher, through the chair, that's correct. I can tell you the part of the inlet where these two pipelines are historically known for a lot of scouring. There's just a lot of movement on the sea floor, and the dirt underneath the pipeline starts to erode and leaving the pipelines exposed. The place these lines are in the inlet just kind of puts them at greater risk for that kind of scouring activity compared to lines elsewhere in Kokomut.
Thank you.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Representative Tarr. Ms. Ryan, I guess what I'm wondering is I have a stack of articles here that I couldn't read through. I could, but my time was limited. There's got to be a dozen articles on Hilcorp's problems. From life and safety problems to oil leaks, gas leaks, fines. Does the department look at all of those things in toto when it's considering things like new regulations, further monitoring, and other sorts of requirements?
Representative Josephson, through the chair, we focus on environmental risks when we decide what regulations need to be put in place. And we are limited to our statutory authority, which is pretty specific about risks to the environment. So, no, I can't say we take a holistic look of past performance on other areas that aren't within our purview. We have a pretty narrow view that is restricted by our statutory authority.
Follow-up?
Still on the natural gas question. We haven't gotten to the oil question. Representative Birch asked about naturally occurring methane seeps, and I see an op-ed that the Senior Vice President David Wilkins wrote where he, in my view, was trying to deflect this issue by saying, well, there are these methane seeps all over the place. But as I noted, the U.S. Pipeline Hazardous Material Safety Administration under the President Trump has pressed the company to stop the leak or shut down the gas fuel by May 1, and it's expressed other concerns about leaking gas in old crude oil pipelines. And I'm just wondering if the department, what's your level of concern? Is it more like the Hilcorp vice presidents or the U.S. Pipeline Hazardous Material Safety Office?
Well, Representative Josephson, through the chair, we are in alignment with PHMSA in the sense that their order actually didn't demand they shut the lines down. It demanded a plan for how they would, and then it's a negotiation between the company and PHMSA. It wasn't quite as direct, I guess, as maybe it came across in the media. But I would also caveat that we are in a fact-finding mode. We need to see if there's environmental risks that are occurring from that release, and at this stage, that's inconclusive at this point. We would need to see there's real environmental damage occurring from a release of natural gas into that aquifer before I think the department would feel comfortable saying there's a reason to set standards in place for natural gas pipelines. At this point, we don't know if that's occurring.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, through the chair. I guess my confusion, Ms. Ryan, is we've had, we've been using natural gas in the world for decades, and there must be some analysis of the impact, if any, on the natural environment from natural gas seepage. Surely that sort of information is known.
Representative Joseph, and through the chair, surprisingly, we've been looking. There really is a dearth of information about a release of natural gas in a saltwater environment.
Okay, thank you.
Ms. Ryan, I have a question. This is Representative Tarr, and I'll want to know this about the oil pipeline. You know, you say it's inconclusive in terms of the environmental impact, but we know this is a critical habitat area for beluga whales. And how is that considered? And in determining that, because that's a different agency than yours, how do the agencies work together to achieve getting enough information to understand that?
Madam Chairman, we work very closely with NOAA and NIMS, who are the organizations that are most concerned about an endangered species like beluga whales. They've been closely working with us to review data that's collected and helping us decide which data we think needs to be collected and where. You know, for example, the depth, where at what point is it most critical that we know there's enough oxygen. So the scientists from those organizations and our own Fish and Wildlife Department, or Fish and Game Department, as well as U.S. Fish and Wildlife, have been working very closely together to review that data and make decisions based on that data in concert. I would mention that while obviously we're concerned about beluga whales, they breathe at the surface. So the dissolved oxygen issue is more relevant for fish, which are what belugas are feeding on. So I just want to make that point.
Thank you. And I have a follow-up. In general, we know that a lot of the pipelines in Cook Inlet, because they're, 50 or more years old, are aging infrastructure. And, you talked about the scouring issue. Do you think, given the age of some of this infrastructure, we're going to be seeing more of these incidents? Or how could we be on the preventative side of this and, take measures that would prevent something like this from happening?
Well, Madam Chairperson, clearly prevention works, and we have a lot of evidence to show when we require prevention measures, we see a reduction in releases. So I'm a big believer in prevention and have been doing quite a bit to increase our authority in the prevention area over the last 2 years. We need to take a look at the infrastructure in Cook Inlet, and we recognize that it's been since 2000 since there's been a real assessment of what's out there, who owns it, what are they doing with it. We do have our standards for pipelines that are the same if it's a new pipeline or an old pipeline, and I can say that Hilcorp has been in compliance with our standards for their infrastructure. Now, are those standards enough for these pipelines? Maybe, maybe not, and we need to look into that.
Thank you. Representative Rauscher, did you have another question?
Yeah, I just had one. Through the chair, this aged infrastructure, I was just wondering, this didn't belong to Hilcorp all along. They bought in to this just lately. So, because I remember the co-chair reading a bunch of incidents that were related to Hilcorp, and I just think that this was probably a situation where they bought some infrastructure which was already aging. And so I just thought I'd bring that up in all fairness.
Ms. Ryan, did you want to comment on that?
Sure, Madam Chairman. Yes, so I think I've been quoted in the news. I mean, Hillcorp, they have come to Alaska and bought a lot of old infrastructure from many companies, and that's sort of their business model, to take older infrastructure and maybe older wells and to keep them working longer. So they do own probably an inordinate amount of older infrastructure compared to some of our other operators. That doesn't mean they aren't maintaining them. It just means they have older stuff. They definitely, Cook Inlet is our oldest infrastructure in the state. Most of the platforms out there were put in the 60s.
Okay. Representative Josephson and then Birch, and then maybe we should transition to the oil leak situation.
Yes, thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Ms. Ryan, I haven't taken environmental law since the mid-90s, but isn't it sort of fundamental black-letter law, just so the public is aware of this, when you buy infrastructure that doesn't work properly, you carry the environmental burden of that infrastructure. Isn't that true? It's like a game of tag. And you may be able to indemnify or seek contribution from a previous owner, but you've touched it and it's yours. Isn't that sort of fundamental?
Representative, through the chair, that's absolutely correct. Our statutes say it's joint and mutual liability. So our first stop, if there's a problem, is the current operator. And a good example of that is the Flint Hills Refinery in North Pole. It is the Koch brothers that we are dealing with, not Williams, who owned the facility for most of the years that probably the contaminant was released.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Birch, did you have another question?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair, and through the Chair, Ms. Ryan, I'm aware that there was, this kind of speaks to, what is more corrosive or leads to pipe degradation between oil and gas. And I'm aware that, because I used to represent the good people in South Anchorage all the way down to Girdwood, they repurposed the fuel line. I think it was a 6 or an 8 inch fuel line that came from Whittier up to at that time Elmendorf Air Force Base, I believe, it was actually built during the World War II. They repurposed that for actually moving natural gas through, or methane. And I guess, is the methane typically less corrosive or less of a problem in your experience with the pipeline? So if you have a line that used to remove oil, but now it's moving the methane, I mean, is that generally speaking a less corrosive product? Through the chair.
Representative Birch, through the chair. I'm not positive. I believe so. I know we have cathodic protection requirements for oil lines. Clearly, we're interested in avoiding any corrosion in an oil pipeline, and whereas we don't necessarily do that with natural gas pipelines, but then again, as I've already mentioned in the past, we haven't considered natural gas an environmental threat. Right. But I would have to get back to you. Let me talk to my engineers about that.
Just curious. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay, Ms. Ryan, how about we transition to the second situation?
Okay, so the second situation started this weekend. It's on the other side of Cook Inlet between the Anna and Bruce platforms. Again, these are platforms and the pipelines that are owned by Hillcorp. In this situation, it's an oil line that had the problem, and it was a line that was going from the Anna platform to the Bruce platform, and from there the oil is transited to another platform, Granite Point, and then on the shore. Again, there was something that occurred. We're not sure what yet. We're still in the investigation mode to figure out what caused the leak. But at some point, oil leaked from this pipeline that is 75 feet underwater, and individuals on the platform saw bubbling and sheening at the surface. At that point, they shut down the production at the Anna platform, and they closed in the line. We then they did overflights and found sheening throughout Cook in the downstream of the platform in various locations. Once they shut in the pipeline, that reduced the pressure in the line down to 5 psi, and at that point we saw no further sheening at the surface. Again, we cannot get a diver into this environment until the ice is completely not completely gone, but at least gone enough that a diver can be in the water and tethered to the boat, and the boat doesn't have to worry about moving because of ice coming in the way. So once the pressure was down to 5 psi, we no longer saw any sheening. We set up an incident command post, which in this situation is led by the state of Alaska DEC, the federal on-scene coordinator, and in this case, that is the Coast Guard because it is a release to water, and the responsible party, Hilcorp. That is what we do when we have a large event or the threat of a large event. We will all three work in unison to make decisions. This incident command post was set up down in Nikiski at the Oil Spill Response Organization, CISPRI's headquarters. They are who are contracted. Hilcorp contracts with them to be their response organization for any releases. At that point, we made plans for Hilcorp. Hilcorp proposed pigging the line with a polyurethane pig, which acts like a squeegee, to push the oil past where they believe the leak occurred. The line has about 50 feet from the platform, had several flanges, and the working assumption was that something happened that made those flanges loose, and that's where the leaking was occurring. It is the weakest point on the line. So their hypothesis was that if they got the pig in the line and they pushed the oil past that point, there would no longer be a release. We wanted to be present when that occurred because we were very concerned something could go wrong, and we also wanted to witness if any sheening occurred while the pigging was happening. The pig increases the pressure in the line up to the level it was when it was initially leaking. So there was a strong likelihood we would at least see some sheening while the pigging was pushing the oil past the leak point. Because we delayed their action to do that pigging so that we could be on site, and because we wanted to make sure their CISPRI, their response action contractor, was on site in vessels with boom and skimmers to be ready if any oil is seen at the surface. So that was delayed until the next morning, which ended up being Sunday. It didn't actually happen until about Sunday afternoon. It just took that long to get everything orchestrated. Us, the state, and the Coast Guard had individuals go out to the platform so we could witness it from that location. And they ran the pig through the line, and it went exactly as we hoped it had, and it pushed the oil past the leaking point, and they continued until the oil was completely out of the line and safely in a holding tank on the Bruce platform. The line had the potential, it was full at the time it was shut in, and we were told the capacity of that line was 461 barrels of oil. So we were quite concerned there was a potential for a much larger release. But again, we consider this a success because the operator did what needed to happen in a safe way. And most of the oil was removed from the line and a safe and no environmental impact other than that initial leak occurred. So it was a successful response, and we shut down the incident command system, and we're now waiting for them to get divers in the water to get down there to see again what caused this breakage and to repair the spot so that they can, before we'd allow them to turn it back on. Any questions?
Representative Birch, then Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you again, Ms. Ryan. Do you have, or CISPRI or whoever the responding entity is, do they have any sort of an estimate of how many barrels or gallons are involved in a potential spill, or are they in a position to make an estimate like that at this time?
Well, Representative Birch, through the chair, that is the hot question I've gotten probably from about 20 reporters. Everybody wants to know how much was spilled. That's unfortunately pretty hard to figure out, even in the best of cases. We have not recovered any oil, so we really don't know how much was released to the environment. The best guess we've got is that it was less than 10 gallons. The company is asserting it was less than 3 gallons. We probably won't ever know exactly how much was released. We know how much the line could hold, and we know how much oil they recovered in the tank. That recovery included water as well, though, because water, as it was pushing the pig through, they use water to push the pig through. Some water gets past the pig and into the oil. So they recovered more volume than we were told the original line could hold. They recovered over 490 barrels of oil, and we were told the line could only hold 461 barrels of oil. So just if you use simple math, they recovered more than they should have. So that would mean a zero leak, and which obviously isn't true. So at this point, the state of Alaska is saying 10 gallons or less was released, and I'm not sure we'll be able to get any more finer a point on it.
Okay. Well, thank you, Madam Chair. That's at least gets a number around it, 3 to 10 gallons or something like that. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Sure.
Representative Josephson.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Ms. Ryan, did Hillcorp provide you with any calculations that showed how they arrived at the 3 gallons released number?
Representative Josephson, through the chair, I don't know how they came to that number, actually. I have to say I don't. They may have provided it at some point in the incident command, but I personally don't know how they came to that number.
Follow up. And was there any third-party verification about the amount of oil, or is that done, or is it, as you suggest, that it's sort of somewhat unknowable?
Representative Josephson, through the chair, it is somewhat unknowable. As I said, our best indicator for how much is released in the environment is how much is recovered, and in this case, none was recovered. So we're probably going to be stuck with a bit of a mystery.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any opinion about whether this related to the structure of the pipeline between the platforms, the Anna and the second platform, or whether it was the impact of ice at the Anna platform itself?
Representative Josephson, through the chair, the cause is unknown. The responsible party, Hillcorp, is saying that their staff on the platform felt a large jolt. We've heard different reports. Some have said there was ice nearby. Some said there wasn't. So we're not sure if it was ice. We're not sure if maybe a boulder rolled across the line down on the floor, although this area of the inlet is not known for that as much as the other area I was previously talking about, but it doesn't mean it couldn't have happened. Perhaps there was some sort of jolt in the production enough to shimmy the pipe enough to shear a bolt at one of the flanges. So it's unknown until we have a diver in the water to see what happened.
One last question. Uh-huh. Ms. Ryan, through the chair, do you know whether there's any change in Hillcorp's maintenance of its pipelines compared to the previous operator?
Representative through the chair, we're looking at their inspection records. We know they had cathodic protection on this line, and we're reviewing the results from their testing of that cathodic protection. We're aware that they were doing sonar work on this line as well as a natural gas line on the other that I was previously talking about. The sonar, the side-by-side sonar, allows you to see if the pipeline is adequately supported. So they were doing the things we expected them to do as part of our pipeline integrity program. So they were in compliance.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, I have Representative Parrish, then Drummond, then Rauscher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I finished the calculations, notepad calculations from the earlier question of the gas leak. It looks like in total, from December to March, assuming mid-December for the start, we lost about 26 million cubic feet of methane through the leak, or about 6 12-inch balloons worth every second. So, just to put it in real terms.
Okay. Representative Drummond. Representative Drummond.
Sorry, Madam Chair. Too much coughing going on in this room. Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Ryan, regarding the incident command center that you mentioned, where is that established, and how many non-Hillcorp staff are deployed to the Incident Command Center, and how many of those staff are State of Alaska employees, I assume DEC?
Representative Drummond, through the chair, when we set up an Incident Command Center, our regulations require the responsible party to be able to man that infrastructure. I mean, it's their job to respond to the spill. It's our job to make sure they're doing it right. So we do staff it. We do have people in various sections of the Incident Command Center to monitor their performance and make sure they're doing what they're supposed to be doing. Now, that said, the head of the Incident Command is the on-scene coordinator, and there are three of those, one from the state, one from the Coast Guard in this situation, and one from the responsible party. They have a large role in the response, and they should, because they're the ones that need to clean it up. But that said, both the state and the federal on-scene coordinator have the ability to disagree and override the responsible party if we do not believe their response is the right thing to do. So it's considered a joint response effort, but the federal and state regulators have the ability to step in and say, no, you're not going to do it that way. You're going to do it this way because that's what we think is the right thing to do.
Follow up? So that command center is established on one of the drilling rigs?
Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Drummond, I didn't tell you where. We do it on land. We set it up. There would not be room on the platform. We set it up at the headquarters of CISPRI, the response organization that was responding for Hillcorp. They have a room set up. It requires quite a bit of space. You can imagine there's probably about 30 to 50 people in this sort of an event. For a large one, it gets up into the hundreds, and we end up having to rent, or the responsible party ends up having to rent a hotel. But this one was in Nisqually at CISPRI headquarters.
Thank you, Chair. Mm-hmm. So how many of these 30 to 50 people are deployed to the site of the spill, i.e. in the inlet at the platforms?
So Representative Drummond, through the chair, none. They are kind of at the command center. We have additional people that were in the field. We had only one state employee, because there really isn't a lot of room on these platforms, and one federal responder was on the platform, and then CISPRI had their responders in vessels nearby. So we have one person in the field to monitor the activity.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank mm-hmm. you, Ms. Ryan.
Representative Rauscher.
Yeah, thank you, through the chair. Does the responsible party or company have to deliver a permit and a design and provide a plan and then have it approved? And what's the process for that fix?
Representative Rauscher, through the chair, we're working on that right now, trying to decide what exactly we want Hillcorp to do specifically before we'll allow them to operate that line again. It depends on the situation, but the department has the capacity to issue an order to Hillcorp under our authority to say these are the things you must do before we'll allow you to operate the line again.
Through the chair, I guess I could need to rephrase that, to work on the pipe.
Oh, Representative Rush, through the chair. No, we that would be more of an OSHA scenario. We don't say in what conditions it's safe to dive in, or the welding. We do set welding standards. We have standards in our regulation for a patch or a repair in an oil line and what standards that patch has to meet, how thick it is, what type of material they use, that kind of thing. So we set the standard, and we leave it up to them to decide how they're going to meet it.
So through the chair. So then they already have you've already prescribed a way for them to fix it. Is that what you just said?
Representative Rauscher, through the chair, yes. We have already standards in place. It's not unusual for a repair on a pipeline. So they already know what they have to do to repair it in a manner that's compliant with our code.
Then, through the chair, am I to understand that this has happened before? Is that what you just said?
Representative Rush, through the chair, I mean throughout the state in general. Our standards apply to all oil pipelines in the state, yes.
Including in the water, through the chair?
Through the chair, yes.
Interesting. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Ms. Ryan, I have a question for you. Who is paying for all of this on the state side of things? Is it all coming from the SPAR fund?
Madam Chairman, we are using our prevention account, which is our daily budget, our standard, you know, operating budget. We are requesting that we utilize the response fund to cover our costs because it's pretty expensive. But that said, we cost recover from the responsible party. So we will be sending Hillcorp a bill for our costs.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Parrish.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One is, what are the approximate diameters, both internal and external, for these pipes?
Representative Parrish to the chair. This oil pipeline is 8 inches in diameter.
Thank you. And apart from recouping your costs, do you know what penalties are being considered for the wanton waste of 26 million cubic feet of methane?
Representative Parrish, through the chair, we are looking at, we have penalty authority in statute for an oil release. The statutes are very specific about our fine authority. So for the oil pipeline, we can issue an assessment, a civil assessment, for up to $100,000 for the initial release and up to $5,000 for every day thereafter. It's based on three factors. It's based on the harm to the environment, the cost to the state to respond, and if there was any economic savings realized by the company that benefited them. For example, they didn't maintain the line adequately, and therefore this occurred. So they had an economic benefit to which caused the release. So those are the three factors we can consider when developing a fine for an oil release.
Continue.
So specifically for oil and excluding natural gas, is that correct?
That's correct.
What would be necessary to allow you to use a fine structure for a natural gas release?
Representative Parrish to the chair, I believe we would need a statute change. I will need to double check that, but that's my take.
Thank you.
Any other questions for Ms. Ryan? I think, Ms. Ryan, we will want to keep in touch with you as things go move forward, and the divers will be able to get out there once the ice, occurs from breakup. So that'll be sometime, I guess, probably in the next month.
Madam Chair, they have said they were hopeful they could get out later this week. We'll see how it goes.
Okay. Closing comment. Representative Josephson has another comment.
Thank you. It's really just for the committee, Madam Co-Chair, and I don't say this lightly, but I reviewing less than the last year's news media, and I know there's some dispute about whether to trust it, but there was a finding by the AOGCC that Hillcorp has committed endemic disregard of Alaska regulations. AOGCC accused Hillcorp of misleading that agency, and it's like every story is about Hillcorp. And my confidence is flagging, and I'm frustrated. I signed a letter. I think members of the then minority almost unanimously signed a letter in support of their Liberty plan of development, and I wouldn't sign that today. And I just wanted to make that comment.
And, Ms. Ryan, I do have one other question. Hillcorp was the company that received credits through the oil and gas tax system, as well as we know, for example, they gave $100 million in employee bonuses. When you assess whether you can give a fine, you know, would the $100 million in employee bonuses and the tax credits they receive from the state be considered economic benefits?
Madam Chairman, no. When I read the definition in the statute, I don't think those would meet the definition.
Okay. Interesting that, we're giving credits and then potentially having fines and problems. So perhaps this will be a topic we can revisit. I think we are out of time for this conversation today. So thank you. I'm sure it's been a hectic time for you for being able to join us with such short notice. But I've received several emails, and I don't know if others have, but I know the news has certainly been concerning for folks in South Central and I'm sure elsewhere. So we really appreciate your time today and hope to keep in touch.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to take a brief at ease, and then we'll do the two bills and the confirmation we have.
Back on record at 2:44. First, we're going to finish our confirmation hearings. This should be the last one for us in the 2017 session. And the hearing in question is for Mr. Adam Trombley. And so, Mr. Trombley, if you'll give us your name, we'll look forward to your statement.
So my name is Adam Trombley, and the main reason I wanted to be on this board is I'm an avid hunter, care about Alaskans having priority access to animals and basically to game. And to ensure that those who are guiding, whether they're guiding Alaskans or they're guiding out-of-staters, or those that provide services to guides or to outfitters, that they abide by the law and that they're regulated fairly and that they follow law.
Okay. This is Co-Chairman Josephson. So you're on the board now. Am I right about that?
That's correct, sir. I was appointed. Well, I guess I would be on the board, although I'm not really sure how it works because I do need to be approved by the legislature. But the governor did appoint me to fill the someone who had resigned, a public member who had resigned.
All right. And do you have any quick opinion about a game concession program on state lands?
I do not have an opinion on that. I don't have enough information at this time to make a statement on that.
Okay. Any questions for Mr. Trombley? Representative Drummond.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Trombley, for putting your name forward. How are you?
I'm doing very well.
I may
How are you?
Have... I'm all right. I'm pretty busy these days, and I'm glad
Good.
That people are putting forward their names to serve on these dozens of board and commission seats. So you were appointed to the Board of Game by the governor. At, what was the approximate date that you began your service?
Well, I don't know the approximate date. I believe it was sometime in February.
Of this year? Of 2017?
Of this year, yes, ma'am.
Okay, so have you attended any meetings of the Board of Game yet?
No, ma'am. There was one that was in March, the first week of March, but I had already had travel planned for at least 6 months prior to that date, so I didn't know at the time, 6 months ago, that I would be appointed, so I was unable to attend that meeting.
All right, and follow-up?
Yes, Representative Drummond.
I'm not sure if I have the right application for you in front of me. It's dated November of 2015, and it says that you were seeking a seat on the Bar Association Board of Governors and that you've been serving on that the Bar Association Board of Governors. Is that correct?
Yes, ma'am, that's correct. So I was appointed by Governor Parnell and approved by the legislature, I think it was in 2012 at some point, and I served out my term, and I wanted to be reappointed, so I had to go through that process, the online process, and in that online process, they asked for other boards or commissions that you're interested in being on, and so obviously my first choice was Board of Governors because I wanted to be reappointed. That my second choice was the Judicial Council, and then my third choice was the Big Game Commercial Services Board.
Okay, I must have the wrong application because the only thing it says you were seeking on that one was the Bar Association Board of Governors, and that it shows that you did serve from 2012 to current but that was the date of the application, which in the copy that I have is 2015. Did you submit an updated application?
Yes, I did. I can't remember the exact time. I can't remember the exact time that I resubmitted that application, but the Big Game Commercial Services Board was my third choice.
Okay.
And Representative Drummond, we can talk to the co-chairs can talk to boards and commissions about this, but that's all I have as well. And I've seen this on a couple other instances.
Okay.
It seems like the system's a slightly less formal than maybe.
Yeah, I'm a little confused because it doesn't say anything about Board of Game.
It's okay. Not Mr. Tromley's fault.
Right. Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Tromley. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions for Mr. Tromley? Okay. I will, I think this is going to be sort of lightning fast. I'm going to open up public testimony as to Mr. Tromley. Is there anyone in the room that would like to speak about his nomination? I don't see anyone on the phone. I don't see anyone in the room. So I'm going to close public testimony, and I would invite a statement of support, not support, but I guess they're called motions for confirmation.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. The Resources Committee has reviewed the qualification of the Governor's appointee, Mr. Adam Tromley, for the Big Game Commercial Services Board and recommends that his name be forwarded to a joint session for consideration. This does not reflect intent by any of the members to vote for or against this individual during any further sessions for the purposes of confirmation.
Okay, so we will take a very fast...
Let's do it at the end.
Okay, at the end of the session, we will make sure to sign the paperwork. We're going to move forward now with House Bill 129. That was the bill that we have vetted a couple times. I asked the Department of Law some questions, and those should have been forwarded to you. I just wanted some clarification on the bill. I got answers that were satisfactory to me. I'm told that there might be a timely amendment. Representative Birch, did you have an amendment you wanted to make?
Oh. Have been shared.
Or if you have
I believe so.
Yeah, basically it would be amendment on page 5, line 30, and it speaks to some of the testimony we had earlier.
Would you move the amendment? Just
so moved, sir. It's amendment number 1, I guess.
Okay.
And it's on the top right corner. It's,
I'll object just for purposes of discussion.
It's 30-GH1687/A.3.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Birch. Would you like to speak more about your amendment?
I think it just speaks to the testimony we had earlier about folks that have every intent of immediately reporting or promptly reporting their something that may be improperly taken in an accident form. And I think it just gives some flexibility recognizing it sometime in remote locations of the state. You can find yourself in a situation where you can't immediately respond. You might be weathered out or have some other issues that are adversely impacting your ability to immediately report.
And I would add to that this has the support of the administration broadly, and also is useful to provide some relief where a person has to, for example, seal a sheep, and so they present before a fish and game officer for that purpose, and that's a nuance that hadn't been considered, and there was some testimony about that. Any other comments about the amendment?
Mr. Chairman, I'll remove my objection.
All right. Any other objections to the amendment? Seeing none, we have the bill as amended before us, and I would entertain is there any other discussion about the bill as amended? Seeing none, I would entertain a motion.
Mr. Chairman, I move that we pass House Bill 129. It's 30-GH1687/A from committee with attached fiscal notes, as amended, with attached fiscal notes and individual recommendations.
Any objection to the motion? I don't see any. So that motion carries. The bill will move out of committee to looks like the Judiciary Committee. And We will, should we sign that paperwork at the end? Mm-hmm. Okay, so we have two things to stick around for, but we will go ahead and move forward with the last item of the day, which is House Bill 130. And if Ms. Foss wants to come forward. We'll take an at ease.
Land uses, so long as the uses are compatible with the primary purpose. State game refuges are designed to protect and preserve the natural habitat and game population. We have 12 SGRs in Alaska, and both critical habitat areas and state game refuges are co-managed by the Department of Fish and Game and the Department of Natural Resources, or the land, private land holder in some cases. So I will move quickly through these. Please let me know if you have any questions at any time. The first map that we have before us is the Eisenbeck State Game Refuge. This is near Cold Bay on the Alaska Peninsula. It was established by the legislature in 1972. And you can see the red areas on the map include tide and submerged land, which was intended for inclusion in the State Game Refuge. The intent of the statute was to incorporate the water bodies within the National Wildlife Refuge watershed. And so adding the entire water body fully protects waterfowl and shorebird habitat, the Bay and Lagoon. These areas that were excluded may have resulted from imperfect mapping of the mean high water in the 1960s and 1970s. And many of the errors that we will look at on these maps today are the result of typographical or mapping errors. So these are mostly corrections with the exception of Dude Creek, which we will discuss at the end. Cape Newenham is also, it's near Eisenbeck, and it is the same scenario with this red piece here that was intended for inclusion. And the Palmer Hay Flats State Game Refuge, this SGR was designated by the legislature in 1975. It is an area surrounding the Matanuska River. The riverbed is owned by the public and the state. The plat was originally surveyed in 1913, and at that time, they surveyed it with a fixed river channel. And since then, the river has, and the streams have meandered, and they no longer follow through the designated description. And so this is impractical for both users and managers, as the area is no longer traversable. So this would incorporate those areas into the state game refuge.
And Ms. Foss, with my apologies for interrupting you, but where land wasn't designated, remind me what it's classified as typically. If it's, it has some generic DNR characteristic?
Well, it would depend on whether some of the land within the Palmer Hay Flats Refuge is private land. There's various land types that will overlap in these areas.
Okay, but just to follow up on that, if it was private, there'd be a fiscal note reflecting a purchase of something.
Right, correct.
So for example, in the Eisenbeck instance, where there are a handful of parcels that would be added, what classification do we give the added part? In other words, what is it called today? Is it multiple use, or what's the term?
It's essentially not a part of the CHA, and so it is state water, and
all
this
right.
will be designated as incorporated into the CHA.
Okay, that's satisfactory. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Moving down to Port Moeller, the Port Moeller Critical Habitat Area was established in 1972. You can see that the demarcations were literally shifted 6 miles west of where they had intended. The statutory description causes the northernmost part to be in the incorrect placement, thus incorporating the community of Nelson Lagoon erroneously into the critical habitat area. So this would be a benefit to the community to be moved out of that critical habitat area and to fix the placement of the boundaries.
All right. So to play a game of Sesame Street where one of these things just isn't like the other, this would be unlike the other three, where there is mankind is going to sort of feel this in some way.
Yes, they're through the chair.
Okay. Sorry to speak so plainly. I just thanks.
Yes.
Okay.
Next here we have the Igigik critical habitat area, and this and Pilot Point, you can both see have non-contiguous segments. And these both resulted from typos in the legislation in 1972. In both instances, one character was replaced in the description, so one instead of two, or N instead of S, north instead of south. And so this legislation would redraw the boundaries so that the previously isolated sections would align with the larger boundaries of the village, thus creating a contiguous people habitat area, which is, of course, less burdensome for management purposes and for wildlife troopers and users all alike.
Representative Birch.
This is all good and everything got through. How do you find this stuff? I mean, it all looks reasonable, but I mean, who is hanging out going, oh my God, look at that. We've got a chunk of this refuge that's not actually included. I mean, I'm just curious. Somebody that looks at maps once in a while.
Through the chair, Representative Birch, that's a great question. I think that this is a bit of a laundry list of issues that fish and game habitat biologists and refuge staff have come across over the years and determined is inconsistent with the original intent of statute. So,
I mean, all looks worthy, again, through the chair, but it looks like as far as the chair made some mention, the impact on people and short of the, was it Nelson Lagoon, I think most of these are uninhabited areas that will probably be may not be seen by many of us in the room in our lifetime.
Thank you. We have a question from Vice Chair Westlake.
Yes, thank you. And through the chair, I'm looking at this and I'm wondering about unintended consequences when you look at the road over at King Cove. Now, is there a reason we are moving this into wanting to make this into a critical habitat area / refuge? Now, what's going on that's prompting this move?
Well, through the chair, Representative Westlake, we are not adding any critical habitat area in this specific instance or in any of them with the exception of the Dude Creek critical habitat area. We are shifting boundaries to align with the original statutory intent. So I'm not sure if I answered your question.
It did somewhat, and we'll have time to examine this. So I thank you.
I have another question, Ms. Foss. It's Representative Josephson for the record. On the Nelson Lagoon instance, is this one where there was some feedback that there was something in the community of Nelson Lagoon that was prohibited, and someone criticized that or complained about that?
Chair Josephson, not to my knowledge, but okay. I do believe that when the community was originally placed erroneously into the critical habitat area, that there was much concern over this.
Okay. And what year would that have been?
That was 1972.
Okay. All right. You can proceed. Thank you. You were in, you'd mentioned Igigik, and I do notice that the line, the right line has shifted to the right a bit, which suggests some expansion of the critical habitat boundary, or is that just not
to scale?
Not to scale.
Yeah.
Perhaps it's Chair Josephson. I do not believe that the actual acreage changes.
All right.
With this.
Okay. Thank you.
Designation.
All right. So you're at Pilot Point.
Pilot Point was the same story as Igigik. It was a transposition of a description, and it's very clear when you look at it to see that there is a segment that was intended to be further north added into the CHA that was erroneously transcribed in the wrong place, which of course doesn't make very much sense when we look at it.
Okay.
Here. Fox River Flats critical habitat area. You can see the purple line here is mean high water. This critical habitat area is in Kachemak Bay. It was created in 1972, and The mean high water line, it divides the uplands from the tidelands and the submerged water, which is critical to the definition of the boundary of the critical habitat area. Along the north and east boundaries, four of the seven Meridian Township Range MRTS sections have tide and submerged lands excluded. However, this exclusion was not applied consistently to either the upland or the tideland areas across the top of that CHA. Mm-hmm. And so this legislation will remove the exclusion so that all four sections, those four sections are created consistently. And those that contain the blue cross-hatching will be consistently treated. And the only areas that are actually affected at this time are the intersection of Bradley River on the east side, where you can see in the bottom map an intersection of the purple, the mean high water, and the crosshatched blue area, which indicates tide and submerged lands that will be now incorporated. Basically, the bay here was sinking for a while, which changed the definition of the mean high water, and now it may be rebounding, and so this definition will allow for a flexible understanding of this over time. Adaptive. And,
Ms. Foss, is there anyone in the Homer community that's expressed any concern at all to the department about this?
Chair Josephson, we have not received any negative feedback. In fact, we've received letters of support from two organizations there in the Kachemak Bay area.
And can you tell us those organizations?
Off the top of my head,
I'm sure we have them.
Yes.
I hope.
I wouldn't want to misname them. Sorry.
All right. Okay. Thank you. So now you're at Kachemak Bay Critical Habitat Area.
So this was created in 1974 as a list of townships and ranges, and only the tide and submerged land and waters within those townships and ranges. The list includes the entirety of Kachemak Bay except for one small corner on the north side of the near the head of the bay. It was an inadvertent omission caused by missing one of the townships named out of the list of 22. If you all are familiar with the excluded area lies seaward of the base of the Switchback Trail, which is well above mean high water and thus would not be impacted. And the beach in front of the Kachemak Silo along the Fox River Flats Trail is already part of the CHA below mean high water, and so longstanding access to that area would not be affected.
Any question?
Yes, Representative Birch.
Just looking at this Kachemak Bay critical habitat, I have killed a lot of critters inside that critical habitat area. Of what significance is a critical habitat area?
Through the chair, Representative Birch, a critical habitat area may have multiple uses. It depends on what the original intent or species or concern was when they set up the critical habitat area, and I might defer to one of the folks online to explain more of the original intent, but critical habitat areas are open to multiple uses as long as they don't conflict with that original intent of protection.
Okay, I think I get it. But okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Foss, is the, and I'll ask, I love this stuff and I can't. The Fox River Flats looks like it's subsumed inside Kachemak Bay. Is it?
Chair Josephson, that is correct.
Okay. All right. Representative Drummond.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You mentioned a location called Kachemak Silo. How do you spell that, and where is that located?
It is spelled S-E-L-O. It is the beachfront area there in the magnified section of the map. Is the best explanation.
Where the blue cross-hatching is? Is that the community immediately above that? The reason I ask is those of us on the House Education Committee have heard this community mentioned as being difficult to get, I believe, school buses in and out of.
Because of the switchback.
Yeah, because of the switchback in the road, which you can see there. I'm just trying to make connections between one part of our duties and the next. Thank you. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Okay.
Representative Rauscher.
Thank you. Through the chair, how you doing? The right side of Cold Bay, that's right where the proposed roadside is, isn't it?
Through the chair, Representative Rauscher, I am not personally aware of how those two areas would intersect, but I could grab one of our folks online to answer that.
Okay, and take note that it's 10 after 3, and I think we've got like 120 seconds, which generally is 2 minutes, and then we need to vacate. So what I'm going to recommend to my committee colleagues is to write their questions down so they're not forgotten, and let Ms. Foss complete a description of Dude Creek, and then we'll know sort of, we'll have a good stopping point there. So if you'll do that.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. The final critical habitat area that we're looking at here is the Dude Creek CHA. This is in Gustavus near Glacier Bay. This is actually an addition to an existing critical habitat area. The land was purchased by the Nature Conservancy in 2004, and they've transferred ownership to the state at that time. And the city of Gustavus has passed a resolution in November of 2016 urging us to have management authority and incorporate that into the CHA. And we have not heard any negative feedback on this at this time, and the addition would go down to the mean high water.
Okay. Thank you. We're going to adjourn at 11 after. We're going to hold this bill. We're going to take it up in short order, probably later this week. We will adjourn to, and we have two more things that we need to sign before we leave. We're adjourned at 11 after 3.